So, let's see how I'm gonna start. It's nice to see everyone. We have three parts of our mission at the Zen Center. One is what we're doing right now, formal practice, as we call it, supporting Zen practice and in its traditional way. The other is this dialogue with the arts, the second one that we do, no eyes viewing wall. Writers come, we have poetry readings, we carry on the expression through the arts that is actually very traditional in Japanese Zen. It's not in any way radical, it's just we do it in a very American way here. And then the third is what we call social engagement or being out in the world, turning our practice from being on the cushion to facing the world, which is actually a natural move of what we call a bodhisattva. It's not, again, it's just the natural process of, it may not take the form of what we call social engagement, it may take the form of how we are at our jobs, it can take a thousand forms, but it is a turning to the world. So, Wake Youth Project is one of those ways. So I just want to talk a little bit about what it is. So it started about 3.5 years ago when someone asked us to begin doing anger workshops, mindfulness and anger workshops with a group of teens. And since then, it has evolved into school-based after-school meditation programs at seven high schools over the years. Four this year, where we've been continuously running groups at four schools this year. We have a weekly Tuesday meditation group here with teens, and that was actually started by teens who came from the schools to here and wanted to start their own meditation group that was open to any teen in Brooklyn or New York, despite their school. And that actually gives opportunities for classes. We have visiting classes all the time. People who are, you know, teachers who want to teach their kids about Buddhism or about mindfulness, they come here, they bring their class, and sometimes this place is full with 45 kids. So that happens. Though there's been administrative issues with actualizing this, one commitment of ours is to continue forward with developing an alternative to detention and suspension programs. Meditation-based alternative to detention and suspension programs in the schools in this city that are often known as zero-tolerance policy schools. They have extremely high rates of detention and suspension as ways to manage the student population. And then a nice offshoot is a lot of our long-term students have been trained to lead meditation groups. They've been with us for about 3 years, and they've gone off to lead meditation groups in churches, in their school classrooms, at other nonprofits that work with teens, at foster care facilities. They've been out there. So it's been rich. And one of the things we're trying to do right now, which would be great, is we co-applied with a grant to deepen our involvement at Jefferson High School, to be not just after school, but actually involved in the culture of the school in the daytime. So we'll see if that happens, which we're super excited about, because ultimately what we're looking at is starting to cultivate a culture of mindfulness in schools and among teens. Now that's about all I'm gonna say formally about Awake Youth. If you guys have any questions about it, I'm happy to talk at lunch or answer any specifics. But what I wanna talk about actually is bodhisattva practice. As I mentioned, this is one way to think about it. And this creates an opportunity for our practice to be in the world. And for me, it's been one of my primary ways to practice over the years, over these last three, now almost 4 years. And so what is a bodhisattva? Technically translates as awakened being, but it's more than just an awakened being. It's an awakened being that continues along the path of liberation to all beings, are awakened. That is part and parcel, that's integral to what it is to be a bodhisattva. It's our way. And it's our way not because the bodhisattva is some selfless path. It's actually beyond any notion of selfless or selfish. The realization is very simple that if there's no separation between myself and anyone else in the world, how is it that my awakening can be separate from the awakening of anyone else in the world? So, awakening self is understood as the awakening of all beings. And we bring that forth. So, I want to read something by David Loy out of this book, which has a great title, Money, Sex, War, Karma. I mean, who's not going to read that book? So, it's like a reality TV show title. Okay, so this is how he talks about bodhisattva. Contrary to the way that the bodhisattva path is often understood, it is not about deferring our own happiness to help others who are less fortunate because they happen to be suffering. It's not martyrdom. That just reinforces a self-defeating and self-exhausting dualism between us and them. Rather, we join together to improve the situation for all of us. As a Native American woman once put it, if you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is tied up with mine, then let's start working together. The point of the bodhisattva path is that none of us can be fully awakened until everyone is. If we are not really separate from each other, our destinies cannot really be separated from each other either. So one thing I really want to be clear is that Awake Youth Project is not helping anybody. We're not, that spirit even is a corrosive one, really. And it really is about being together in an awakening process that is happening as much for the instructors of Awake Youth as it is for the people who are being instructed. We're both being instructed. We're all being instructed. And it's a co-awakening in that way. And a place like this, hopefully, is going to be a little bit of a bodhisattva generator, you know? I mean, Brooklyn Zen Center, other Dharma centers, we kind of come in, we put ourselves on the bodhisattva conveyor belt of Zazen. You know, it's like, when I say that, I think of that. Who was the guy who did Looney Tunes music? Carl Stalling? Yeah, dun 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 dun. That goes on for about 2 decades. And then we pop out bodhisattvas. And so, we're at that easy. So anyway, what's the nature of the conveyor belt? So I want to talk, the nature of the conveyor belt is the paramitas. I mean, this is what we actually practice with. This is what our Mahayana ancestors are very clear on and very much in agreement. Okay? There's not a lot of debate. If you want to come out the other side as a bodhisattva, you practice the paramitas or the perfections. So, I'm going to talk about them in a very linear, foundational way. First one's the foundation for the second, foundation for the third. There are many ways to talk about it. You can talk about them circular. You can talk about them like we do about the precepts, where you look at any precept and all of them are in the precept. You know, every paramita includes all of the paramitas. But today, just because, you know what? I don't have a clock. So, let's start with the first. Thank you. The first one is Dana Paramita. It's really already 12:30? 11:30. 10 minutes fast. Okay, good. 11:30. That's good to know. So we talk about Dana Paramita. That's everywhere in our practice. We have it everywhere. We give Dana to our teacher. We have opportunities for Dana for a scholarship fund. It's generosity. It's unconditional generosity. we meet the community with the dana of our labor. We meet it with our effort. We meet it with everything. In fact, a community like this rests on dana. But more importantly, our practice rests on dana. It's the gateway paramita. It's the way to enter in to the practice of the perfections. And there's a reason for it, because in the giving, we come to see that actually there, we often talk about no giver, receiver gift. In the process of giving, we wake up to that the flow of life is coming and going, filling us, coming out of us. We are a vessel for a process. We're a thoroughfare for the life energy of the universe. And an example, you know, I'll give a few examples throughout this about what has happened in terms of working with the kids. When I first got asked to go to that anger workshop, I had this idea in my head, at least partial, not completely, but partial, that I was taking the practice to the kids. You know, and this is going to be good, and they're angry, and I was angry as a kid, and it helped me, and it's going to help them. And when I got there, it became clear very quickly that I wasn't bringing the Dharma. The Dharma was already there. And I just had to show up, you know. I had to show up and be a part of what was actually arising between myself and these young people in the room. And that exchange, it became clear that there was, you know, it wasn't even a back and forth. It was a, you know, together and gone. That is the nature of our reality all the time. It's a showing up to be a vessel of giving. And dana, you know, the interesting thing about dana practice is, for some of us, it might be hard to give at first, but really is about both ways. I mean, to give monetarily is tough. It might be a little harder to give emotionally. Maybe a little harder, even more, to get and to receive than it is to ask, which is one of the reasons I love the Siddhathon so much, as you guys know, because we don't have a monk's beggar bowl tradition anymore, which is kind of too bad, because there's something really humbling about just standing in a street and going like this. You know, somebody told me one time that they were in Japan and they saw somebody come by and just tip the rest of their Coke into the bowl. Which I thought, okay, you know, sometimes the universe gives you the dregs of Coke when you ask. But being on that end of it too. So someone asked me one time, or actually, no, not someone asked, this was actually in our precept group. Someone asked why giving isn't a specific precept. For you that don't know, precepts are kind of the ethical codes that we follow or that we devote our life to. One of the reasons that giving is not an explicit part of the precepts is they are kind of framed in a prohibitory way. But the other reason is because generosity actually is the foundation of all of our ethical practice. It's the spirit in which we bring ourselves to it, which brings me to the second paramita, which is the ethical practice rooted. It's an ethical practice, but it's rooted in our commitment. It's rooted in a commitment to do no harm, and it's rooted in our commitment to harmony. So it really is the beginning of talking about community, about looking at ourselves as ethical beings, and in a way, what Dana Paramita does, which is really lovely, is we begin through the vulnerability of letting ourselves be open to the flow of the universe, which is completely uncontrollable. We begin to trust the world. And I think it's one of the reasons that it's first. Because if we can't trust the world, it's very hard to stand up in the world. And ethical practice is us beginning to stand up in the world. And so they become the guide and really the skeleton on which we hang our activity and our interactivity. So we vow to do what's good, we vow not to harm, and we vow to awaken with all beings. And then there's 10 precepts, specific precepts that go with that. And the and as I mentioned, that just that practice is, it's easy with an ethical practice to become rigid. You know, it's very easy to kind of beat ourselves up, and with generosity as the foundation, we look back when the condemnation starts and the rigidity starts. We look back to generosity. You know, am I being generous with myself? Am I, when I see somebody else do something that I'm, not so good, am I being generous with them? Yeah. So for me, you know, if I get stuck, a lot of times it's because it's not actually the ethical practice that's the issue, it's the one before, it's generosity that's the issue. Yeah. So we have this practice of generosity. And the neat thing is, it's no accident that these are the two things that are really emphasized at the Zen Center first. You know, we talk about dana, and then we talk about ethical practice. We study the precepts. We talk about them together. These are the two feet of Sangha. And we go back and forth between the two. So the practice of dana helps us see that we are not alone, that we're not some individual completely responsible for all the energy of the universe, or all the energy of our lives. And then we can stand up in that. And the other thing that's great about it is I really feel like generosity enlivens. It's a life-giving energy to the ethical process. We get out there and we're doing it, and it's our own ethical struggles are the opportunity to be generous. Dana is this incredible potential energy. Okay, but then there's this ability through ethical practice with each other that it gives a shape to dana in the world. It gives a shape to generosity in the world. We get to be generous with one another. We get to act on it. I remember when, there's another Awake Youth story. We've been studying mindfulness of speech for years. And you know, right speech is hard for adults. For teenagers, it's Olympic. But we've been studying it for a while. And one thing that was really, really clear to me, was a little shocking when they first came, was there was a lot of teasing around ethnic stuff. Like, kind of a little mean. And I would point to it, and they would say, "Oh, Greg, you're just too serious. We're just playing. It's not a big deal." You know, and I say, okay, and part of me was like, okay, I'm learning to communicate with them too. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm missing something here. It's okay. And I point to it and be back and forth. Then about a year and a half in, we were talking about right speech again. And one very brave young woman just came out, her voice just came out of the whole milieu. And she said, "You know what, I actually hate when people make jokes about being Haitian. It hurts me, I take it personally, I don't like it, and I don't think it's funny." And she was the only person in all of that, "Oh, it's okay, blah, blah, blah," who kind of put her foot down and said, "No, it's not cool." The level of vulnerability to come forward authentically like that and actually speak from one's pain, it changed the whole thing. The place went quiet. And very quickly, that way of speaking started dropping off. Now they come in, they love each other, and they're hugging, and they're always encouraging and everything else. And you think, oh, these are the greatest kids in the world. But, you know, there was, and they will say, oh, it's because the Zen Center is this wonderful, safe place, and blah, blah, blah. But that's not actually what happened. What happened was that they authentically experienced the pain, the suffering of a person, and they made an ethical decision to stop talking that way. And the safe place came out of them, not out of these walls. You know. And the same goes for us. You know, it's a safe place for us because we've made an ethical decision not to speak a certain way, and we share that. And so people can trust. And this is the interesting thing. In Dana, we begin trusting the world. With our ethical practice, we begin trusting ourselves and each other. We cannot do it prior to that time. We are not trustworthy prior to that moment. Not that trustworthy even after, but you know, it gets better. But it's not easy. I mean, the thing about ethical practices, I think out of all the paramitas, it's the one that shows us, this is kind of true and kind of not true, but you know, it's the one that really shows us our conditioning in the most detailed way. You know, we want to not take what's not given, and then I accept a free coffee from a person who's not the owner of the cafe. Did I just take what is not given? I don't know, maybe. And it's a little like, or we get really frustrated with it, or there's despair because we go into, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to do these impossible, this and that, and this and that. And this comes up a lot in precepts group, where we really do, you know, the frustration and the sometimes confusion and maybe overwhelming nature of precept practice comes forward. So, because the paramitas are ingenious, the antidote's the next paramita, which is kshanti, which is patience, or forbearance, or forgiveness, or tolerance. So we start getting shaky in our ethical practice. We start feeling like it's not working out, and we start practicing patience. And the neat thing about patience is it allows us to be with our ethical struggles. That's one thing. But if we're generous with our ethical struggles, patience comes about. So it's the support and fruit. All of them are the support and fruit of each other. So the second paramita shows us our limitations, and patience allows us to be patient with our limitations. You know, in a way, it's not really possible to understand patience. It's not possible to understand patience without intention. If we don't have an intention that gets frustrated, we can't see our patient. We can't see the limitations of our patients. So we have to have the intention. We have to have the wholesome intention. That has to be there. And then we start seeing our limitations. You know, I love the patience paramita because it's the one I'm worst at by far. I'm high energy. I want to do everything at once. I have frustrated many people because of it. And there's one thing that really, but it's more than the thing that comes up for me. You know, here's an interesting thing around patients right now. So because of the kind of kids we work with, we work at underserved high schools. And these high schools mostly are, all of them have big giant metal detectors. It's like you're going into the airport every single time you go in. And the kids are all lined up, and it takes forever to get in, and they're frustrated, and there's altercations, and it increases the chances of altercations because you're dealing with the police all the time. And the interesting thing is that the disciplinary line has been moved from teachers and principals to police. I was afraid of the principal when I went to college. I mean, went to high school. They're afraid of the police. They couldn't care less about the principal. It's like they're not even there. But so they have these metal detectors. They're surrounded in neighborhoods that have really active stop and frisk policies and habits. The suspension and detention rates, as I mentioned, are very high. They're used to basically control the school. And all that's difficult enough, but we are finding out, the people who are interested in these things, that and here's where my patience starts to get challenged, that these suspension and detention rates are being shared with the police, which is not that crazy since the police are there and they're kind of co-controlling the school, but that in turn, that those same suspension and detention rates are being, especially suspension rates and then arrest rates, are being shared with prisons who are using them for projection and planning. Yeah, exactly. So this is the school-to-prison pipeline, as we like to talk about it, and it's one of the reasons we're really focused on an alternative to a detention suspension model. Now, the thing is I know that the school-to-prison thing involves a lot of people who need a lot of jobs, and it affects people's income and affects a lot of things. So my mind doesn't go to blaming individuals. I don't think there's somebody controlling the puppet strings, but there is, it's painful, and sometimes anger comes up, and sometimes I'm not very patient with it. But this is what I was talking to T about earlier. The wonderful thing about patience and why it is incredibly overrated, I mean underrated rather. It's not overrated, it's very underrated. Although at 20 I would have said it's way overrated. Is that when I get angry, it is very clear to me now that it's because I'm not letting myself be with the heartbreak around what is actually happening. I'm not being patient with what's happening. I'm not being patient with the information. I'm not being patient with the difficulty of all of our collective ethical struggle. And when I am, the heart opens up. And the heart opens up, and at first it's like, ugh, who wants to do that? But this really is the pivotal bodhisattva point. And this is where it turns, you know. Because it's the open heart that can hold the complexities of suffering without reactivity. It's not the mind. Not the intellect. It's not an educated Buddhist. It's the open heart that can hold the complexities of suffering without reactivity. And it's patience that allows that heart to emerge. And so the other side of patience is what we call virya, the kind of the two legs, patience, and then virya is energy or effort or enthusiasm. I like enthusiasm because it comes from the Greek root, which means to be full of God. You know, it has an idea of like having a God within or a divine inspiration. It's big, you know, it's not little. And you know, this virya just comes out. I mean, when we're generous with ourselves and we're ethically practicing and we're patient and our heart opens, we want to respond. That's what's going to emerge. Now, we're paying attention to virya, we're paying attention to energy and effort the whole time. But over time, what begins to happen is that our stickiness to all of the stuff going on in our minds starts to quiet, you know. It moves from the energy of the mind to the energy of the heart. And when that stickiness starts to quiet, there's no way you're going to stop energy from coming up. You're going to have more energy. You're not wasting it. You know, so you're not wasting it on attaching to thought or attaching to some idea of who we are. You know, I'll just say that, you know, for me, virya, you know, when I say I'm not good at patience, I'm really good at this one in terms of lots of energy, but not skillful, you know. Sometimes what will happen is, you know, I have lots of energy. I want to respond. My mind wants to respond to everything. Okay, here's an issue, here's an issue, here's an issue, there's an issue, and I just want to respond to it. And that's all great. It's kind of sweet, but it's also kind of stupid because it's, you know, there's no understanding in that kind of response that number one, I'm already everything and everything is responding to everything. I don't need to personally respond to everything. You know, the world is responding to the world. I have my place and there are limitations, and I can do that. So really realizing where we are as a dependently co-risen being, but also not to push too hard. I push, you know, I personally have a habit of pushing, and I've had to watch it very closely over the years. And, you know, it kind of goes in the category of it's coming from a good place, but it really kind of sucks. But it's, you know, it doesn't, it's not that helpful. So Donna connected us and Sila stood us up. And patience allowed us to be whole with the struggle of suffering. And enthusiasm lets us step forward. And we can respond. And whether this is our own personal practice on the cushion and understanding our own egoic patterns, or whether this is responding to the pains of the world. You know, we have the Bodhisattva vow that we'll chant at the end. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Sometimes we say awaken with them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. You know, we talk about how these are impossible, but our world is such that we really need to become adepts at impossible vows. And the enthusiasm of a bodhisattva can meet that. You know, it's not, this isn't something that's beyond us. This is something that actually is what we are. It's just a matter of patience and enthusiasm. But what's the Marianne Williamson poem that Nelson Mandela is always famous for? Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. Bodhisattva gives up that tininess. And the energy that, you know, the inability to tolerate that energy, it's just because our self-addicted habit patterns don't want to be blown apart. Because they will be. So how do we deal with it? The next paramita is jhana, or concentration or meditation. So we do that a lot around here. We sit still. We're with a mind of ease. And the nice thing about that is that our energy can go off in 1,000 different directions, and meditation gathers it. You know, the Buddha discovered something that I still feel is so brilliant, which is that he understood that the mind could not settle into its awakened nature if it was not practicing ethically. Everybody else was doing lots of concentration states, trying to be like, you know, blast through it. And you can do that. It's not stable. But you can do it. You can concentrate your way right past any suffering. But it won't last. But the pointing the mind to wholesome activity allows it to not be distracted by all the nonsense that is necessary for unwholesome activity. The lying to yourself, lying to others, singing you this, pumping yourself up, hating yourself, blah, 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 blah. It's on and on and on and on. You know, you can just stop all that. The other side is that, so we have sila, right? We have ethical practice for that. But then the other side is, if we're too tight, asceticism, ascetic ethical practices, then the mind can't settle into its awakened nature either. That's where generosity and patience comes in. And then if we don't have virya, if we don't have energy and enthusiasm, the mind is just kind of dull. So bright, awakened nature are these four paramitas. They are the culmination in the practice of these four paramitas. And then the fifth one, which is kind of the gathering practice. We're gathering it. Now, one thing I want to say is that notice that meditation is the fifth of six paramitas. Okay? The practice of awakening is not just meditation, it's the practice of all six paramitas. And the reverse of it is, it's also the practice of meditation. That's also in there too. So, meditation allows the mind to settle into a stream, allows all that energy to settle into a stream. It'll gather. It might be a gentle brook, it might be wild horses running, but it's a stream. And it can respond. And that brings us to prajna, the kind of icing on the cake, which is translated as wisdom, understanding, discernment, insight, cognitive acuity. But one thing that's really important about prajna is this is not just some kind of collected knowledge that we get over the years. What I like is about, now this, the Sanskrit, as I understand it, is that jna means knowledge or understanding, but pra is the neat part. Tell me if I'm right on this, Yeshwan. Pra is a modifier that suggests being born or springing up. Okay, so prajna is not some wisdom that we pick up somewhere and hold on to and have ready. It's that the practice of the other five paramitas result in a mind that can respond appropriately to what arises right now. So it's that's the practice part of it. Now, some people define, sometimes it's defined as understanding the three marks of existence and impermanence, suffering, and no self. For purposes here, I would say that's just kind of, we could talk about that for weeks, but I would say it's shorthand for what the bodhisattva is responding to. But with prajna, ultimately, we're able to see the world and all its particulars as one dependently co-arising whole. And we don't start separating it off. There are the particulars. There's the two truths. There are the particulars. There are people suffering. There are individuals struggling. There is joy and sadness and places and things and Brooklyn and Manhattan and all of that. And there's not. And there is the unconditioned source of everything that we experience that is quiet and infinite. The bodhisattva comes from that quiet, infinite space and responds to the particulars. So the prajna wisdom is not a wisdom that doesn't take into account the conditioned. In fact, it's responding to the conditioned. It's just not coming from the conditioned. It's coming from the unconditioned. It's coming from the ultimate, but it's responding to the conditioned. When we see this fully, the heart turns from being concerned with the self in the practice of the awakening of the self to the world, the practicing the awakening of everything. Because there isn't, you know, what was the destinies are intimately, every destiny is intimately tied up with my own. So where does Awake Youth Project come into it? There are no children that are not intimately tied up with our, whose liberation and whose destinies are not intimately tied up with our own. There are no neighborhoods, there are no cities, there are no countries, there are no places, there are no struggles, there are no joys, there is nothing that is not intimately tied up with our destinies and our liberation. That is the communication of the paramitas. That's what the paramitas are asking us to see. And that's what they're also supporting us in seeing. right now, I think I have 5 minutes. Right now, with the teens, we're practicing guided metta. May all beings be safe. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be at ease. Now, bodhisattva is going to come from that space. But bodhisattva can also turn those into questions of compassion. What beings are not safe? What beings are not healthy? What beings are not happy? What beings are not at ease? Avalokiteshvara Kuan Yin here. That heart listens for the answers to that those questions and holds those answers with patience, enthusiasm, uprightness, generosity, a calm meditative mind, and responds with prajna. One responds, you know, in many ways, we don't really mention the word compassion, but in many ways the paramitas are the practical definition of compassion. They're compassion in action. They're cultivating compassion. One response is to teach mindfulness and meditation to teens. There are lots of responses. The other day I was listening, to a Lauryn Hill song coming back from Erasmus the other day. And I was listening to her album, and then this song, Everything is Everything, came on. And I was listening to it, and I thought, you know, this song really, I've worked with these kids for a very long time now. For teens, 3 years, some of them, sometimes. And so I know them pretty well. And there is a real excitement and anxiety and concern about what their future's like, what it's going to be. They're not seeing lots of opportunities now more than ever. And so she wrote this song. She literally wrote this song for young people. If you don't know who Lauryn Hill is, she's a hip-hop, reggae, soul R&B artist. Grew up in Newark, across the water. She's pretty brilliant. But these are the words. I wrote these words for everyone who struggles in their youth, who won't accept deception instead of what is truth. It seems we lose the game before we even start to play. Who made these rules? We're so confused, easily led astray. Sometimes it seems we'll touch that dream, but things come slow or not at all, and the ones on top won't make it stop, so convinced that they might fall. Let's love ourselves that we can't fail to make a better situation. Tomorrow our seeds will grow. All we need today is dedication. And, you know, it's it really is this, it's so, she really let herself fall back into who she was as a teenager, because it's such a spirit of where they are right now. It's beautiful and sad and hopeful and all of it. And it's a complex world. I mean, none of us chose our positions. None of us decided where we are in it. We take responsibility for each other. We take responsibility for each other here. We show up to sit. We think we're showing up sitting for each other, but I mean for ourselves, but we're really showing up sitting for each other. We just don't know that yet. But so here's a practice. TM on Wednesday night asked people to walk around the city looking from their heart chakra. Not from their heads and their eyes, but from their heart chakra. So I'm going to back that up, and I'm going to add something a little. Try letting every child in the street be your child. And try letting every person in the street and everything you see be you. And see what it is to live from that place. For me, when I am able to do that, I find myself taking care of what's nearest much more skillfully than I do when I don't do that. On the two sides of it, in terms of the two truths, in terms of finitude and the infinite. You know, the finite doesn't need to limit us. It doesn't, the particulars and all of that, there doesn't need to be limits to seeing the world in all of its individuality. If we forget that we are one indiscernible whole in one way, then our love will be constrained and limited. But if we don't see that there is all of this, then where are we going to direct all that infinite love? That's where it's directed. That's where we know. That's what we're meeting. That's the suffering we're meeting. We're meeting the reality of suffering in a world of individual people who are struggling. But it's coming from a place that doesn't make some worth it and some not. So I am happy that this community is, that it decided last year to support this program, and that people have really offered themselves, and people step up to the team. The people who come here are very embraced. They love coming here. They feel loved coming here. They feel safe coming here. And they feel, and I could tell you scores of stories about how, you know, mindfulness group helped a person do this instead of that and supported this. But if you guys practice, you know what it does. I don't need to convince you. The poster says, support the illumination of young hearts through meditation. That's what we're doing. We're supporting the illumination of young hearts through meditation. We're providing a foundation that lets fear drop away and love emerge. That's what we do for each other here. That's what we're doing in this program. So there's two platforms, and there's really two platforms for us to stand on. We can either stand on fearful separation, or we can stand in loving presence with all beings. Those are our two shots. Those really are the two options. And we move from one to the other, slowly. What brings about the first, the fearful separation, seems very individual and incredibly complex. What brings about the second is letting go of everything that brings about the first. So, as we move from fear to love, I'm going to end with a quote from Dr. King. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. Martin Luther King said that. But that ultimate reality for the Bodhisattva is not the end game. The end game is ultimate reality, love all beings. Ultimate reality, love all beings. Ultimate reality, love all beings. And sometimes the door gets caught in the wind and it's love all beings, love all beings, love all beings, love all beings. But the door swings both ways. Thank you. May our intention.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by the Brooklyn Zen Center. Our programs are given free of charge and made possible by the donations we receive. For more information on supporting Brooklyn Zen Center, please visit the giving section of brooklynzen.org.